Hard to believe, but Passover is less than 4 weeks away. This past Thursday evening, the moon was full, and basically 4 weeks to the day, we will be observing the Passover in 2019. That is hard to believe, but time flies by. You know, during this remaining time, between now and then, as Mr. Ellis mentioned, you know, we'll be examining ourselves as we're told to do, and going over the, you know, our looking at ourselves and our conduct, our values, what's in our heart. We'll be preparing, we'll be repenting as we have need of, and we will be in a position to begin again the keeping of God's holy days in their cycle as we do on a year-to-year basis, and be reminded and refreshed as to the significance and the order and the meaning of each of the holy days as we come to them. And the first, you know, the first days that we will keep, the Passover and the days of unleavened bread, are just upon us. You know, one of the things that we're reminded of again on an annual basis is the sacrifice of Jesus Christ for the forgiveness of our sins and for our physical healing. This afternoon, what I'd like to do is to take a look at the subject of crucifixion. It's a difficult subject to look at, it's a difficult subject to focus on, and certainly my purpose in doing this is not to make us feel bad, to make us feel down, but hopefully to present some information to you this afternoon that will help all of us to more deeply discern what Jesus Christ did for us, what those symbols portray, is with the shedding of his blood, with the breaking of his body, and we'll look at those aspects of crucifixion, and hopefully we can come out of this afternoon, a month from the Passover, with a greater appreciation, a refreshed appreciation, and a deeper discernment of the sacrifice that Jesus Christ and God the Father gave for the forgiveness of our sins and for our physical healing. Hopefully we will see, as part of this as well, we will see what the people that were adversarial to Jesus Christ, the chief priests and the officers that they referred to, those that were screaming out for his crucifixion, we will see what they were asking for. We will see what they had in their heart, so to speak, and when they were talking to Pilate, or when they were interacting with the Roman officials, we'll see a little bit more in detail what was on their mind, what they were really asking. This was not, the trial of Jesus Christ was not a polite, formal legal proceeding that we might observe, you know, on television in the coverage of some trial, or civil or criminal, you know, with the decorum that's there and the order and the presentations and, you know, the arranged fashion with the prosecution and the defense. This was something very different than that, very different than that. This will be divided up into about three parts. The first part we'll take a look at is the prophecy in Isaiah about the sacrifice of Jesus Christ. And then the second part will be the history of crucifixion, and also the variety in the practice of crucifixion in the time that crucifixion was used in capital punishment. And then finally, we will take a look at the gospel account of the crucifixion. All four of the gospels have it. It's a challenge to weave those and blend those together to come up with most of the highlights and with the things that in some cases are only recorded by one of the gospel writers. So that's the approach that hopefully we will take. I'd like to start in 1 Peter 2. I can read it to you if you'd like. It's a very well-known section of Scripture. 1 Peter 2, we'll read verses 21 to 25. 1 Peter 2, verses 21 to 25. And this is something that, in the case of anointings, is always comes to mind, whether I'm being anointed or whether I'm asked to anoint someone else. One of these verses always comes to mind as part of this, and it points to the sacrifice of Jesus Christ. Again, 1 Peter 2 and verse 21. For to this you were called, because Christ also suffered for us, leaving us an example that we should follow, or you should follow, in his steps, who committed no sin, nor was deceit found in his mouth, who, when he was reviled, did not revile in return. I don't know about you, but that is exceedingly hard to do when someone is in my face or they're being rude or belligerent or whatever is to not respond in kind. That is very difficult for me to do. Hopefully it's, you know, maybe you don't have the same challenges with that. But Jesus Christ, when he was reviled, did not revile in return. When he suffered, he did not threaten. And isn't that a natural response? You know, we're going to get even, or we're going to say this or that, you know, to those that might be confronting us. But Jesus Christ did not threaten, but committed himself to him who judges righteously. Verse 24, who himself, that is Jesus, bore our sins in his own body on the tree, that we, having died to sins, might live for righteousness, by whose stripes you were healed. And that's the part of this section that, I, as I mentioned a second ago, that always comes to mind when I think about anointing, that by the stripes of Jesus Christ, we have the privilege, the opportunity to be healed. And that healing is not only physical, it's spiritual as well. And I was thinking about that this morning, that to me, one of the greatest blessings possible is resurrection to spiritual life. You know, the forgiveness of sin that enables that as part of the process, that enables that to take place. What a fantastic opportunity that we have to be healed. And it's as a result of the stripes that Jesus Christ bore on his own body for all of us and for each of us. Concluding in verse 25, for you were like sheep going astray, but have now returned to the shepherd and overseer of your souls. Now then, let's turn back to that prophecy in Isaiah, and we'll read part of 52 and 53 in Isaiah. And this is the section here that points forward, and that the Apostle Peter was actually quoting from Isaiah when he wrote these words. In 52, let's start in verse 13, and some of this I may skip to not necessarily belabor the point. But starting in verse 13 of Isaiah 52, behold my servant, and every one of the capitalizations here refers to Jesus Christ, or just about every one of them. My servant shall deal prudently, he shall be exalted and extolled and be very high. Just as many were astonished at you, so his visage, his face, was marred more than any man, and his form more than the sons of men. So shall he sprinkle, and the marginal reference to me is a lot clearer, so shall he startle many nations. Kings shall shut their mouths at him, for what had not been told them they shall see, and what they had not heard they shall consider. And then in Isaiah 53, the part that they're continuing the same thought. Verse 1, who has believed our report, and to whom has the arm of the Lord been revealed? For he, that is Jesus, shall grow up before him as the tender plant. And as a root out of dry ground, he has no form or comeliness, and we see him, there is no beauty that we should desire him. He's despised and rejected by men. We will certainly see that when we read the account of how he was treated by the Romans and how he was treated by the chief priests, the Sanhedrin, and all of those in that group. A man of sorrows and acquainted with grief, and we hid, as it were, our faces from him. He was despised, and we did not esteem him. We also have the example of the Apostle Peter that denied Jesus Christ three times. Surely he's borne our griefs and carried our sorrows, yet we esteemed him stricken, smitten by God, and afflicted. But he was wounded for our transgressions, the point of the sacrifice, the objective and the purpose. He was bruised, he was wounded for our sins. To reread that part, he was wounded for our transgressions, he was bruised for our iniquities. The chastisement for our peace was upon him, and by his stripes we are healed. And that's the quote that the Apostle Peter made. All we like sheep have gone astray, we've turned everyone to his own way. The Lord has laid on him the iniquity of us all. And his sacrifice was for all of us, all who have ever lived. He was oppressed and he was afflicted, yet he opened not his mouth. He was led as a lamb to the slaughter, and as a sheep before its shears is silent, so he opened not his mouth. And again, as the Apostle Peter said, he didn't revile, he didn't threaten. How incredibly difficult that was to do. He was taken from prison and from judgment, and who will declare his generation? For he was cut off from the land of the living. For the transgressions of my people he was stricken. Restatement of the purpose of the sacrifice. And they made his grave with the wicked. I mean, he was crucified with two malefactors, that they're called, two criminals. We'll touch on that later. With the rich at his death. And that was Joseph of Arimathea that got the body of Jesus Christ after he was taken down, and that put him in that new tomb. That was a wealthy man's action at that point. Because he had done no violence, nor was any deceit in his mouth. Yet it pleased the Lord to bruise him. And that in that sense, it didn't give God the Father pleasure to do that, but that was part of the plan. The Lamb of God slain from the foundation of the world. That's the plan and the purpose of the Father and of Jesus Christ, to accomplish that little clause there in Hebrews 2:10 that describes the objective of the Father and Jesus Christ as bringing many sons to glory. That's what the plan is about. That's what their purpose, that's what all of the holy days point to. That is the means. The holy days outline the means whereby that goal of bringing many sons to glory is accomplished. It pleased the Lord to bruise him. He has put him to grief. When you make his soul an offering for sin, another restatement, he shall see his seed, he shall prolong his days, and the pleasure of the Lord shall prosper in his hand. He shall see the labor of his soul and be satisfied. By his knowledge, my righteous servant shall justify many. He justifies us all that accept Jesus Christ and go through the steps of repentance and baptism and living a godly life thereafter, walking in newness of life, as the Apostle Paul puts it. Continuing in verse 12, therefore I will divide him a portion with the great, he shall divide the spoil with the strong, because he poured out his soul unto death. He was numbered with the transgressors. He bore the sin of many and made intercession for the transgressors. And that's the prophecy that points forward to the crucifixion of Jesus Christ, God in the flesh. Okay, I have about four different sources that I'd like to read from. The first one is from the Encyclopedia Britannica, the online and online version of it. Yeah, there's unfortunately a good bit of overlap between these accounts of the methods of crucifixion and some of the aspects and the history of crucifixion. And I hope that rather than that being boring, that we can see that there is a good bit of commonality here, you know, in these accounts, but there's a little variety as well. And we'll see that there was not just one type of crucifixion, that there's a lot of variation here. And so when we read the gospel accounts, we will see, and you will recognize some of the things that I'm about to read here, but there's others that are not included. The point of some of this is the history, but there's also the variety of the practice of crucifixion as the form of execution. So from the Encyclopedia Britannica, it says this: there were various methods of performing the execution. Usually the condemned man, after being whipped or scourged, dragged the crossbeam of his cross to the place of punishment, where the shaft, the upright shaft, was already fixed into the ground. Stripped of his clothing, either then or earlier at his scourging, he was bound fast with outstretched arms to the crossbeam, or nailed. He was either roped, tied to it, or nailed to it. So there's variation there. The outstretched arms to the crossbeam, or nailed firmly to it through the wrists. The crossbeam was then raised high against the upright shaft and made fast to it about 9 to 12 feet, approximately 3 meters from the ground. Next, the feet were tightly bound or nailed to the upright shaft. A ledge inserted about halfway up the upright shaft gave some support to the body, and that was for the hips or for the buttocks. Evidence for a similar ledge for the feet is rare. Over the criminal's head was placed a notice stating his name and his crime. Death ultimately occurred through a combination of constrained blood circulation, organ failure, and asphyxiation as the body strained under its own weight. It could be hastened by shattering the legs with an iron club, which prevented, you know, the person being crucified from supporting the body's weight with the legs, and made inhalation or respiration more difficult, accelerating both the asphyxiation and the shock. One of the things about the different parts of what a person was crucified on, nothing was done for the comfort of the person that was being crucified. That's the takeaway from that. Everything that was done as part of these varied practices was done to prolong the suffering of the person that was on that cross, on that stake, whatever, and we'll get to some of the different ways that people were crucified. The point is, nothing was done to ease the suffering. Crucifixion was designed to inflict a maximum amount of pain. It was designed to prolong suffering. And we look, by contrast, at capital punishment in the 21st century, and we see in many cases efforts are made to make it as quick and as painless as possible. That's exactly the opposite of what crucifixion was in the past. There's examples of, and this article continues, that crucifixion was most frequently used to punish political or religious agitators, pirates, slaves, or those who had no civil rights. And then there's examples listed that go back as far as 519 BCE, where that King Darius of Persia, King Darius I, crucified 3,000 political opponents in Babylon. And it's close to the time of Christ, about 88 BCE, there was a Judean king and high priest named Alexander Janneus who crucified 800 Pharisaical opponents, you know, people that were at odds with him. One of the things that I find myself doing, and I would suspect that you're probably in the same situation, is when we have a mental image of crucifixion, what unfortunately comes to mind for most of us, or at least it does for me, is the artwork that I may have seen. You may see it on stained glass windows, you may see it in paintings, and it will, a lot of times it is presented as something like this. You will see a very handsome man with very aquiline features, long hair. There will be, in many cases, this crown of thorns that's pressed down. You'll see a few drops of blood. You'll see that the individual had some clothing on in the lower parts. You'll see maybe a small cut in the right side. And then you will see perhaps in the palms of the hands some, you know, holes or the nails. And then the same thing with the feet being crucified through the instep or the top part of the foot. That is very inaccurate. That's very inaccurate compared to what the customary practice of crucifixion is. So, you know, when we talk about crucifixion and you think about what the mental image that comes to mind, you'll have to resist some of the way that art has portrayed crucifixion, because that can be very, very misleading. The second article is called The History and Pathology of Crucifixion, and it's from the National Center for Biotechnology Information. That's a website, and it's in the section of the U.S. National Library of Medicine, and the National Institutes of Health. This article says it like this: in antiquity, crucifixion was considered one of the most brutal and shameful modes of death. Probably originating with the Assyrians and the Babylonians, it was used systematically by the Persians in the 6th century B.C., so we're talking 500-plus years before Jesus Christ, crucifixion was already being used for capital punishment. Alexander the Great, according to this article, Alexander the Great brought it from that part of the world, from there to the eastern Mediterranean countries in the 4th century B.C. Phoenicians introduced it to Rome in the 3rd century B.C., and it was virtually never used in pre-Hellenic Greece. That the Romans perfected crucifixion for 500 years until it was abolished by Constantine I in the 4th century. And if the dates, if my memory is accurate on the date, it was something like 341, you know, AD, that Constantine abolished the use of crucifixion. So So from somewhere around, 800 plus, 900 plus years, this was the method that was used in many parts of the ancient world for capital punishment. And again, it was designed to inflict maximum suffering, maximum pain. Crucifixion in Roman times was applied mostly to slaves, disgraced soldiers, Christians, and foreigners, only very rarely to Roman citizens. Death, usually after 6 hours, could go on as long as 4 days of an individual being on that stake or that cross or the apparatus. So that's something to keep in mind. 6 hours minimum to 4 days on that cross. Since death was due to, and some of this is medical terminology, it's a little dry, but it is what it is. Multifactorial pathology, after effects of compulsory scourging and maiming, hemorrhage and dehydration causing hypovolemic shock. Hypovolemic shock is a medical condition that occurs when the blood flow is reduced due to blood loss and the heart can no longer circulate and can no longer pump blood out to the body. And that's fatal over a period of time, but it's not quick. But the most important factor was progressive asphyxia. That is, you're running out of oxygen, you're running out of air, caused by impairment of respiratory movement. Resultant anoxemia, exaggerated hypovolemic shock. Death was probably commonly precipitated by cardiac arrest caused by vasovagal reflexes, and that has to do with response to different stimuli, and that it basically, you can go into shock, and it's describing going into shock from that. And it can be causing severe pain, body blows, and the breaking of large bones. The attending Roman guards could only leave the site after the victim had died. So it wasn't get it started and then head for the barracks. Typically there was a group of four Roman soldiers or four soldiers that participated in the crucifixion. They were required apparently to stay there until the person that was being crucified had died. And they were known to precipitate death by means of deliberate fracturing of the tibia and or fibula, spear stab wounds into the heart, sharp blows to the front of the chest, or a smoking fire built at the foot of the cross to asphyxiate the victim. Some of what we will see as we continue with some of this is you will see the imagination of human beings when they are in a power to cause harm or to cause hurt to another individual, and the variety of things that people come up with to do something like this to another person. Let's take a look at on what was the crucifixion done. And historically, there were many different things that a person could be crucified on or crucified to. It could be simply a stake in the ground, just an upright stake. And the stake wouldn't have any appendages, with no arms or cross pieces or anything like that, just basically like a tree trunk with no limbs. And then there were several different types of crosses. And without the ability to show you those, and I'll use this phraseology, some of the crosses looked like a lowercase T, where you have the vertical part there, and then you have the cross piece, but you have an area above the cross piece. That's a lowercase T when we look at it. Another type of cross was the capital T, and that is where the cross piece on top had nothing that protruded above it. And then the center column was what held the cross piece up. So we've got the lowercase T, we've got the uppercase T, and then there was also a cross that was formed in the shape of an X. And tradition has it that Andrew was crucified on an X-shaped cross. And there is in so-called religious history, there is a reference to a St. Andrew's cross that apparently is in the shape of this X. And so that, with that X shape, then, the hands and the feet were affixed to different part of that in a similar way as they were to, to either of the T-shaped crosses. There were also variations historically where that, and tradition has it that the Apostle Peter was crucified upside down. And in those cases, the cross piece was much lower down, so the cross in that sense was inverted as well. And because of the orientation of a person being head down, apparently the person being crucified didn't last nearly as long as they did in what the material refers to as the head up, you know, position. But the cross could either be, you know, with the cross piece up, or it could be the cross piece down, and the person being executed would be crucified head down on that cross. Crosses were comprised of two parts. There was one called the stipes, S-T-I-P-E-S. That's the vertical post. And the crosses were not necessarily assembled before execution. The cross piece was actually mobile, and it was detached. That was called the patibulum, and that's the crossbar. And we'll see that basically from a different reference material online, it said, once the victim arrived at the execution site, the patibulum, that's that cross piece, was put on the ground, and the victim was forced to lie upon it. Spikes, about 7 inches long and 3/8 of an inch in diameter, were driven into the wrist. And remember, we've seen the art where Christ is depicted as having been crucified through the palms. That's most likely not accurate because the weight would actually cause the hand to tear, and a person would not be able to support their weight in a prolonged fashion, you know, in that particular position. So they were the nails were driven in through the wrists, and there is this part of the wrist here was the target. There is a medial nerve that goes right through that. That part of the wrist, that it's said to be excruciating when that is penetrated. Now, I just read where the spikes were about 7 inches long and 3/8 of an inch in diameter. This is a fencing spike. This spike is 3/8 of an inch in diameter, but it's 10 inches long. So if I cover up about 3 inches of that, then you can see that this spike right here, the size of it, the weight of it, the mass of it, you know, it could very easily hold the weight of a human being. And so you can imagine the pain and the suffering that would result from something like this being driven through this part of your wrist. It was not the palm of the hand, it was the wrist. The phraseology that talks about the hands, according to the reference material, says that refers to anything from the elbow down. So it's not something that is, when it says hand specifically, that it refers to just the five digits and the palm and that part. It's basically anything from the hand all the way down to the elbow. So it is accurate to say that there's no conflict with that the crucifixion, the nailing of the hands would have been done through the wrists. And again, that's to hold the person up to inflict the maximum amount of pain. I want to show one thing by contrast here. This, and it's hard to see from your distance, this is the 16-penny construction nail. These are very commonly used in framing and construction, or that they used to be. And you can see by comparison, this is 3.5 inches long. And so if we have a 7-inch spike that's 3/8 inch in diameter, then we see, you know, the massive difference in, you know, what was used to, you know, in crucifixion. There's a lot of different numbers about the geometry of the nails, how long they were, how big they were, that kind of thing. And over, you know, 800-900 years, there would have been a lot of changes in terms of what was available. So it wasn't something that was necessarily consistent throughout the usage of crucifixion. It was basically what was expedient. But it had to be robust. Hence, something the size of a six or seven inch, you know, spike that is three-eighths of an inch in diameter. The spikes would hit the area of the median nerve, causing shocks of pain up the arms to the shoulders and neck. Already standing at the crucifixion site would have been the 7-foot-tall post, and that's the stipes. Again, and there's all kinds of different dimensions for those. Some of them say up to 12 feet. This particular source said about 7 feet tall. And again, it was called the stipes. It's already placed in the ground. In the center of the stipes was a crude seat to support. And again, I use that it's in quotes, but the support was for prolongation of agony, not the provision or the providing of comfort or of relief for the victim. The patibulum, that's that cross piece, was then lifted onto the stipes, and the victim's body was awkwardly turned on the seat so that the feet could be nailed to the stipes. At this point, there was tremendous strain put on the wrists, arms, and shoulders, resulting in a dislocation of the shoulder and elbow joints. The position of the nailed body held the victim's rib cage in a fixed position, which made it extremely difficult to exhale. That was the thing that really struck me about this. I always thought that, you know, if your arms are raised, that inhaling would be the problem. But the medical evidence is that that particular position with the pain that a person was subjected to and hanging there, supporting their weight in combination of their feet, perhaps that little seat, and their hands, that the problem was you couldn't exhale. You couldn't get the air out of your lungs. And that prolonged the agony, that prolonged the suffering and the death. That it made it extremely difficult to exhale, impossible to take a full breath. This last source is the Journal of the Royal Society of Medicine. It's a site from the UK. And it's entitled Medical Theories on the Cause of Death in Crucifixion. A couple of authors there and this is a little more of an erudite type of a presentation, so you'll have to bear with the language. By way of introduction, they stated like this: crucifixion may be defined as a method of execution by which a person is hanged, usually by their arms, from a cross or similar structure until dead. It's been used in many parts of the world in many time periods, but it's perhaps best known today as a cruel method of social control and punishment in the Roman Empire around 2,000 years ago, or, you know, the time of Christ. In modern times, the medical profession has shown considerable interest in crucifixion. The typical aim of articles by this group has been to determine how crucified individuals actually died. And they often focus on the case of Jesus of Nazareth. And this goes back, they talk about a book written by a doctor named Stroud in 1847, and that's the earliest reference that this material goes through. And so they list 10 different medical professions, and then they have the speculation of cause of death by each of these 10. And again, the point here is variety. The point here is the lack of conclusiveness about how a person might die. But there's five physicians, there's a forensic pathologist, there's another pathologist, there's two surgeons, and there's a hematologist. Their expected causes of death in studying crucifixion are as follows: cardiac rupture, heart actually ruptures according to one, heart failure by two, hypovolemic shock, syncope, which I had to look up. I didn't know what that was. That's low blood pressure. And again, from all the blood loss that took place as a result of the scourging and the crucifixion itself. And then there's acidosis. There's asphyxia. You know, you basically can't breathe. You run out of air. You run out of oxygen. And then the effect on the heart, arrhythmia plus asphyxia. And then a pulmonary embolism is possible. And on and on and on it goes. But not one size fit all. So depending on the individual, depending on how they were crucified and their constitution, death could have been from a variety of causes, not just a single cause. You know, and they say after this, you know, with large numbers of theories proposed for any problem in a scientific discipline, this often demonstrates that there's no conclusive or no clear evidence concerning the answer. And you think, yeah, right, that's exactly what it is. And then they go on to talk about, and I want to drop down here and read a couple of historical quotes. One of them from Flavius Josephus. And Josephus was a Jewish historian that lived from around 37 AD until about 100 AD, and he wrote of hundreds of Jewish prisoners crucified at Jerusalem in 70 AD. And that's when the Romans basically came down and and suppressed the rebellion in Jerusalem with great violence. And here's what Josephus had to say about what he observed. They were first whipped and then tormented with all sorts of tortures before they died. They were crucified before the wall of the city. They were outside the city, apparently. The soldiers, out of wrath and hatred that they bore the Jews, nailed those they caught to the crosses in different postures by way of jest. So here's hardened combat troops. There's no mercy, no quarter given here, and they're crucifying people any which way they want to, just whatever comes to mind. Another historian that lived from basically 4 BCE or 4 BC to 65 CE, Lucius Annaeus Seneca, recorded another mass crucifixion and noted, and this is his quote, "I see crosses there, not just of one kind, but made in many different ways. Some have their victims with their head down to the ground." I'll skip part of the other, it's too graphic. Others stretch out their arms. And this was how that, you know, the point being, there wasn't just one way that crucifixion was done. And again, the art that you may see, the paintings, pictures, whatever, in many cases is very inaccurate. A little bit more. In Roman times, a common starting point was to be whipped across the back, buttocks, and legs with what's called a flagrum or flagrum. It was a short whip with sharp objects interweaved into the thongs. The victim was then often obliged to carry part of their cross, and that would be that patibulum, to the place of execution outside the city walls. So the weight of this would obviously vary depending upon the region and the type of wood used. Once at the place of the crucifixion, the hands and feet of the prisoner were fixed to the cross, either with nails or cords. And you think about being tied to it, that still has the same effect physiologically on your respiration. You still got the same problem with not being able to exhale. You can't inhale a complete breath, and you have difficulty with exhaling. Plus, you've been beaten to a pulp in preparation for execution. So you've already lost a lot of blood. You're already shocked by what you've experienced to this point. If crucified head up, the victim's weight may also have been supported on a small seat. Mentioned that already. Again, this is overlapped. This believed to prolong the time it took a man to die. Victims in the head-up position could spend several days on the cross before they died. One technique used by the Romans to hasten death was to break the legs below the knee with a blunt instrument. Modern interpretation in medical literature as to how this might work includes, and this is how it contributes to the crucifixion, includes blood loss from the fracture, a sight or respiratory failure from fat embolism. Those positioned head up, then respiratory failure might also ensue as a consequence of the inability to inflate the chest sufficiently since the legs could no longer support the weight of the body. However, it's unknown which of these three widely stated hypotheses is correct. And then they go on to... This article talks, and I just want to mention it in passing, there has been one case where there was archaeological evidence found of a crucifixion, and this was in 1968 that there was a picture, or there was a bone fragment found, and it had a 4-inch rectangular spike through the upper part of, it wasn't through the foot, it was more through the ankle, and there was still a piece you could see where the nail was bent, and the speculation was that with the spike, that the desire was that the person could not pull their foot out of the spike, so there was a piece of wood placed here, like as my hand is, and then the spike would be driven into the foot, and that wood would keep the person's foot from being able to move off of that position. A gruesome picture, but that is the only archaeological evidence that has been brought forth as to actually showing, you know, what could have been done in ancient times. And then the conclusion on this from this article is that our conclusion is that at present there's insufficient evidence to safely state exactly how people died from crucifixion in Roman time. You think, yeah, there's a lot of medical evidence there. But basically the bottom line is that there was a variety of ways. So there wasn't one way that fit all. Now then, what I'd like to do in this last section is let's turn and let's look at the biblical account in the four Gospels of the crucifixion of Jesus Christ. And there are, for your reference, there's four chapters in the New Testament that all cover this. Matthew 27, Mark 15, Luke 23, and John 19. We don't have time to read all of those, but we'll read parts of them. Let's start in the 18th chapter of the Gospel of John. 18th chapter of the Gospel of John. We'll start down in verse 28. And this, we're going to skip some of the predecessor material here. John 18, verse 28. So then they led Jesus from Caiaphas to the Praetorium, and it was early morning, but they themselves did not go into the Praetorium, lest they should be defiled, but that they might eat the Passover. And so we know this was in that year, Wednesday. The high day was on Thursday. They were trying to get this done, wanted to get this done so that they could abide by their traditions in this case, even though they were out to commit murder. An amazing contrast here that we're focused on religious, you know, items on our religious checklist here, but our objective is we're trying to execute someone. We're trying to kill someone. Pilate went out to them and said, "What accusation do you bring against this man?" They answered, "If he wasn't an evildoer, we wouldn't have brought him to you." I'm thinking, well, there's a real definitive answer. And in 31, that then Pilate said to them, you take him and judge him accordingly to your law. Therefore the Jews said to him, "It's not lawful for us to put anyone to death." Are we after justice or are we after death? They were after homicide is what they were after. They were out to get him killed, and their own words were, "In our law, we can't put any man to death. But if we can get you to decree it, then it can be done, because we want this man killed." There was somewhere else that says in just one short little verse, and said they were full of envy, or they had envy of Jesus Christ, and that was one of the things that drove, you know, the chief priests and those that were part of that entourage. Is they were envious. They didn't want to lose their position in that society. So, you know, they said, "It's not lawful for us to put anybody to death, but we want you to." That's what they were, that's the unwritten part. "That the sayings of Jesus might be fulfilled, which he spoke, signifying by what death he would die." There's a couple places that's referred to. Very specifically, it's in Matthew 20 and verse 19, where Jesus Christ predicts his death by crucifixion. And it's also mentioned in John the 12th chapter in a couple of verses 32 and 33. Continuing in verse 33 in John 18, Pilate enters the Praetorium, calls Jesus and said to him, and then there's the dialogue there back and forth, "Are you a Jew? And, you know, are you a king? Where's your kingdom from?" and all of that. And then Pilate, one of the things about the dialogue here that I find really interesting, it's very difficult for me to determine, you know, the tone of voice, the level of sarcasm, you know, all of those things that go on. There's a couple places where, you know, the word sneered is used. And I think, yeah, now that kind of puts a little bit more of a meaning to the nature of the dialogue here that's going back and forth. But I think when Pilate said, "What is truth?" I don't think that was a question expressing interest. I think he was just, you know, "What is truth?" You know, it's a philosophical issue, you know, who knows? That's just my spin on it. But unfortunately, there's not any clarification of, you know, why he expressed that thought and how he expressed that thought. But basically concludes, "I don't find any fault in him at all." That's what he said in the latter part of verse 38. Continuing the last two verses here. "But you have a custom that I should release someone to you at the Passover. Therefore, you know, who do you want me to release? You want the king of the Jews?" And they all cried again, saying, "Not this man, but Barabbas." Now, Barabbas was a robber. Continuing in the 19th chapter of John in verse 1. So Pilate took Jesus and scourged him. The purpose of scourging was preparation for execution. And the scourging was done, according to some sources, in a pattern across the back, from the outside in toward the spine diagonally. And it was designed to hurt. It was designed to tear and cut flesh. It was designed to cause blood loss and shock. And so Pilate had this done to Jesus Christ in preparation for what was going to take place ahead. Verse 2, the soldiers twisted a crown of thorns, put it on his head, and they put on him a purple robe. One of the things about crucifixion was, almost without exception, from what I've been able to read, people were crucified without any clothes on. Now, the art is never going to show that, or almost never show that. So that is an incorrect way of portraying the actual crucifixion of Jesus Christ. But in this case, we've got the soldiers doing things. You know that crown of thorns wasn't just placed lightly and carefully upon the head of Jesus Christ. I would imagine it was jammed in there. And you think about some of the thorns that we have on trees and bushes in East Texas, and you can imagine the pain to the scalp when those thorns penetrate all the way to the bone, and they rip and they cut and they hurt. They really hurt. And then the soldiers in verse 3 says, "Hail, King of the Jews!" You know that's scorn, that's scornful and that's mocking. And they struck him with their hands. These weren't little light slaps. You know, these are a garrison force there in Jerusalem. These were active duty soldiers. I would imagine that if it was an open-handed strike at all, there was a lot of power to it. What I expect was it was closed-hand strikes. They were punching Jesus Christ in the face and in the head, you know, and again, taking out that rage, you know, on him and inflicting, you know, the maximum amount of damage that they could in those circumstances at that time. The only thing they didn't want to do or couldn't do, was to beat him to death at that point. Because, again, the scourging was preparation for the execution. So again, we want to start and inflict the pain, start this blood loss process, this shock process, and then we're going to move from the scourging on to the actual execution. Pilate in verse 4 says, you know, "I'm bringing him out to you that I don't find any fault in him." Verse 5, Jesus came out wearing a crown of thorns and the purple robe, and Pilate said to him, "Behold the man," and that had to be scornful. I mean, there's some mocking going on between Pilate and the Jews, between the Jews and Jesus Christ, between the soldiers and Jesus Christ. You know, it was not a pretty picture at all. And verse 6, it said, "Therefore, when the chief priests and officers saw him, they cried out." And cried out is an understatement here. In other places, that they were enraged. There was shouting. One of the Gospels makes a reference to that Pilate was concerned about the tumult that was taking place with these people screaming out, "Crucify him, crucify him." You know, it's a mob mentality. And then Pilate finally says to him at the end of verse 6, "You take him and crucify him, for I find no fault in him." And the Jews, you know, then they go on through that. And let's drop down here. There's some dialogue between Pilate and Jesus about, you know, where the power, you know, because Pilate makes the comment, you know, "If you don't talk to me, don't you realize I have the power to crucify you?" And Jesus Christ's answer was an amazing answer. That, you know, "You could have no power against me unless it had been given you from above." And that's absolutely true. In another place, in a discussion with the disciples, he said, "Don't you know that I could pray the Father and he would send me 12 legions of angels?" A legion at that time was 4,500 troops. So you can imagine, say, 50,000, you know, spirit beings coming to his rescue, and what that would have meant for Jerusalem and the surrounding area—total annihilation. But he just said, "I could do that." He obviously chose not to do that. Why didn't he do that? Because it was the plan from the foundation of the earth for Jesus Christ to give his life for the forgiveness of all of mankind. Let's see, where am I here? Let's see. Let's drop down to 14. Now, with the preparation day of the Passover, about the sixth hour is noon. And he said to the Jews, "Behold your king." And they cried out, "Away with him, away with him, crucify him." And Pilate said to them, "Shall I crucify your king?" Got to be sarcastic, just needling them. And the chief priest answered, "We have no king but Caesar." I wonder if they remembered that in 70 AD when Caesar sent, I believe it was 4 Roman legions, and they basically destroyed Jerusalem. And, you know, they destroyed the temple at that time. I wonder if any of them thought about, you know, those circumstances when Caesar exercised his kingship in a very Gentile way there. 16. Then he delivered him, that is Jesus, to them to be crucified. So they took Jesus and led him away. And 17, and he bearing his cross went out. So he's carrying something. And it's not clear from this whether he was carrying the whole cross or whether he was carrying the cross piece. And there's differences in the different accounts. But he went out, bearing his cross, went out to a place called the Place of the Skull, and where they crucified him and two others with him, one on either side, with Jesus in the center. And then it has what Pilate wrote on those, and then it had down there in verse 23, and the soldiers, when they had crucified Jesus, remember there's four of them, took his garments and made four parts to a soldier each part, and also the tunic. And so then they cast lots as to who was going to get the finer garment, because none of them wanted to destroy that, and that was prophesied. And the soldiers did those things. Now then, let's jump over to the 20th chapter of Luke and read three verses there in, and this is only recorded, as far as I know, in the Gospel of Luke. 20th chapter, verse 28. And this is when Jesus is in that process of bearing, carrying something. You know, and then I'm not on 20, I'm in 22. I've got an error in my notes here. It's not the 23rd chapter. 23rd chapter of Luke, verse 28. And this was right after, you know, they asked Simon a Cyrenian, to do some of the carrying, and they laid the cross on him that he might bear it after Jesus, as it says back up in 26. But Jesus Christ, in the middle of this, when he's being taken out to be crucified, then says this. Jesus turning to them, and he's talking to those in Jerusalem. "Daughters of Jerusalem, do not weep for me, but weep for yourselves and for your children. For indeed the days are coming in which they will say, 'Blessed are the barren wombs that never bore and the breasts which never nursed.' Then they will begin to say to the mountains, 'Fall on us,' and to the hills, 'Cover us.' For if they do these things in Greenwood, what will be done in the dry?" Now, I'm curious about that. I don't know if Jesus Christ is referring specifically to the destruction that took place in 70 AD, or if he's referring to the end times in that case. I don't know about that. I'm not sure. But I find that particularly interesting that right in the middle, with what he'd already been through, having been scourged and abused and tortured, you know, in that previous evening after the Passover and after the foot washing, then to have gone before Pilate, and then, you know, we've got the interaction between Pilate and Herod that is given in one of the other accounts, and then finally he's taken out, he's on his way to the site where he's going to be crucified. Now then, let's turn back to the 15th chapter of Mark. 15th chapter of Mark, and we'll read. Mark has a little bit more detail in one section than any of the other gospel writers did. Mark the 15th chapter, down in verse 21. Then, and this, you know, basically recounts that Simon Cyrenian was tasked with bearing the cross. And then, you know, they gave Jesus wine mingled with myrrh to drink, but he did not take anything. And when they crucified him, they divided his garments in 24, casting lots for them to determine what every man should take. Now it was the third hour, and they crucified him. That's 9 a.m. in the morning. So Jesus Christ went through this mock trial, so to speak, with the Jewish officials and with Pilate and with Herod. 9 a.m. he's taken out and he's crucified. And then there's this connects back to something that I read to you earlier. Remember when we said that typically the minimum amount of time that anybody lasted was about 6 hours? Well, Jesus Christ was crucified at 9 a.m., and we'll read here in a little bit that he died about 3 a.m. that afternoon. So he was on that cross or that apparatus for those 6 hours. And then now let's drop down to verse 33. Now when the sixth hour had come, there was darkness over the whole land until the ninth hour. So from noon till 3 p.m., it's dark. And at the ninth hour, Jesus cried out with a loud voice, saying, "Eloi, Eloi, lama sabachthani," which is translated, my God, why have you forsaken me?" And then, typical fashion, people are trying to figure out what he was saying, and you know, was he calling for Elijah and all of that, and the confusion that resulted from that. But at the very end of that, in 39, so when the centurion who stood opposite him, and there would have been somebody in charge of those four soldiers, or one of the four soldiers, who stood opposite, saw that he cried out like this and breathed his last, he said, "Truly, this man was the Son of God." Then let's go back to the 19th chapter of John and finish this part of the crucifixion, or the account of the crucifixion. The 19th chapter in verse 31. 19 and verse 31. "Therefore, because it was the preparation day that the body should not remain on the cross on the Sabbath, for that Sabbath was the high day, that coming Thursday, the Jews asked Pilate that their legs might be broken and that they might be taken away." Remember that? They used an iron bar or some type of an apparatus, and they would break the lower legs. One source said that in some cases they would break the femur, the upper leg. I don't know if this is accurate or not, but there was a comment made that some think that the breaking of the femur is the most painful thing that a human being can experience. I have no idea how that was derived, but you know, to fracture somebody's legs is a brutal thing to do, and that was what the Jews wanted done. Let's break the legs and get this over with because sundown's coming. Then the soldiers came and broke the legs of the first, and that is the ones crucified on either side of Jesus, and the other who was crucified with him. When they came to Jesus and saw that he was already dead, he didn't die apparently from the spear wound. He didn't die, it was obviously his legs were not broken. He was already dead at that point. So he had succumbed to one of those other causes that we read about that some of the medical professionals speculated that result from being crucified. Soldiers break the other's legs. They're going to break the legs of Jesus Christ, but he's already dead. And at that point, one of the soldiers in verse 34 pierced his side with a spear, and basically he's making sure that Jesus Christ was dead, but he was already dead. 35, "And he who has seen has testified, and his testimony is true, and he knows that he's telling the truth so that you may believe. For these things were done that the scripture would be fulfilled, not one of his bones shall be broken." So he was beaten incredibly, but no broken bones and no broken legs, as was the practice at that time. Don't butt out of time, but I want to take just a second to take the concept of crucifixion. And let's look at the magnification of and the amplification of the meaning and the usage of crucifixion in a couple of other places in the New Testament. Galatians 2:20, which is a memory verse for a lot of folks. But think about that in the context of the meaning of what the Apostle Paul wrote when he's using the word crucified. Galatians 2:20, "I have been crucified with Christ. It's no longer I who live, but Christ lives in me, and the life which I now live in the flesh, I live by faith in the Son of God who loved me and gave himself for me. The Apostle Paul uses a powerful word there. He doesn't, he's very specific, and that word has, to me, a lot greater meaning after, you know, some of the reading about the practice of crucifixion. And in Galatians 5, verse 24, he says this, "And those who are Christ's have crucified the flesh." They've crucified the flesh, not just put on a fresh coat of paint, not just kind of put it in the closet somewhere, put it out of the way. This is an action word. This is an action verb. They've crucified the flesh with its passions and with its desires. And I think that's an aspect of our individual self-examination when I have to say, well, have I been that vigorous and that focused in my efforts to grow spiritually that I've crucified, I've gone to that extent and that effort to subjugate the passions and the desires of the flesh? I have to say, no, I haven't done that. I haven't gone after it with that degree of focus and that vigorously. But I'm really struck by the phraseology of the Apostle Paul when he says, "And those who are Christ have crucified the flesh with its passions and with its desires." You know, today we've looked at the practice of crucifixion in the Roman Empire. It's very sobering to look at the detail of what Jesus Christ endured as the payment of the penalty for our personal and our collective sins. I think each of us can greatly appreciate the agony that he went through and that prolonged torture that he endured so that we could have our sins forgiven. I want to conclude with two verses in Hebrews 12 that I'll just read to you. They're read very frequently here, but I want to emphasize a part of verse 2 in a little different way. Hebrews 12, verse 1, "Therefore we also, since we're surrounded by so great a cloud of witnesses, let us lay aside every weight and the sin which so easily ensnares us." Captivating expression. I mean, we think, you know, is it really hard for us to sin? No, that's our default action. That's the way of the flesh. That's what we've got to guard against. The old man's hard to keep below the waters of baptism. Real hard to keep below the waters of baptism. And if we're not careful, if we're not on guard, we get ensnared very easily, very quickly. "Let us run with endurance the race that's set before us." Verse 12, "Looking into Jesus, the author and finisher of our faith, who for the joy that was set before him," the joy that was set before him, "endured the cross, despising the shame, and it sat down at the right hand of the throne of God."